York. This is Democracy Now.
All of the women who testified as witnesses in this case took the oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help them God, or affirm the oath. They all subjected themselves to cross-examination. What they testified to is evidence that can be weighed by the jury.
Jurors begin deliberations today on whether to find disgrace movie mogul Harvey Weinstein guilty of rape and sexual assault. He pleaded not guilty in the case that's become a flashpoint in the Me Too movement. We'll get an update from New York Magazine's Irene Carmon, who interviewed more than a dozen of Weinstein's 100 accusers. Then, as Bernie Sanders polls at number one, Mike Bloomberg qualifies for the next debate, and former Vice President Joe Biden hopes for a comeback in the next round of Democratic primaries, we'll look at a new film that documents Biden's extensive role in advocating for the Iraq War.
Joe Biden did so much more than vote for the war. He was the chair of the powerful Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, and he really used his control over that committee to make sure that a majority of the U.S. Senate voted to authorize the war. It's questionable whether the authorization to start the war could have even passed Congress without all that Biden did to get it approved.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Over 2,000 former Justice Department officials are now calling on Attorney General William Barr to resign after he intervened to reduce the sentencing recommendation for President Trump's longtime friend and former campaign adviser Roger Stone. The Federal Judges Association has called an emergency meeting as the fallout over Barr's actions mounts. Meanwhile, U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson, who's presiding over Roger Stone's case, is holding a conference call today to discuss the status of the case 2 days before he's due to be sentenced. Last year, Stone posted a photo on Instagram of Judge Berman Jackson with crosshairs near her head. Last week, Trump also attacked Judge Berman Jackson on Twitter. Judge Beryl Howell, the chief judge of the U.S. District Court for D.C., responded in defense of Berman Jackson, saying, quote, "public criticism or pressure is not a factor." Mike Bloomberg has qualified for the next Democratic debate after receiving 19% in a national NPR PBS NewsHour and Marist poll. He needed at least 10% to qualify. The Democratic National Committee was recently widely criticized for overhauling its debate requirements to eliminate the need for candidates to obtain a significant number of small donations. Bloomberg has poured over $400 million of his own money into his campaign. The debate will take place Wednesday night in Nevada ahead of Saturday's caucuses. Bloomberg is not on the ballot in Nevada. Senator Bernie Sanders leads in the same poll with 31%. In related news, Bloomberg's coming under fire yet again for his past remarks. This time, the former New York City mayor can be seen telling an audience at Oxford University in 2016 that farming requires less gray matter than working in the information economy.
I could teach anybody, even people in this room, so no offense intended, to be a farmer. It's a process. You dig a hole, you put a seed in, you put dirt on top, add water, up comes the corn. Then we had 300, you could learn that. Then you have 300 years of the industrial society. You put the piece of metal on the lathe, you turn the crank and the direction of the arrow, and you can have a job. And we created a lot of jobs. 98% of the world worked in agriculture. Today, it's 2% in the United States. Now comes the information economy. And the information economy is fundamentally different because it's built around replacing people with technology. And the skill sets that you have to learn are how to think and analyze. And that is a whole degree level different. You have to have a different skill set. You have to have a lot more gray matter.
The now viral video comes as Bloomberg is facing a barrage of criticism over his past comments and actions on policing, race-based housing discrimination, stop and frisk, and sexual harassment and discrimination at his company. A 1998 lawsuit details an interaction with a female employee he shouted at in front of others after she expressed trouble finding a nanny. Bloomberg allegedly yelled, quote, "It's a effing baby. All it does is eat and bleep. It doesn't know the difference between you and anyone else. All you need is some black who doesn't even have to speak English to rescue it from a burning building," unquote. In another incident, Bloomberg allegedly told a pregnant worker to, quote, "kill it." And in another lawsuit in which an employee accused her superior of rape, Bloomberg was asked in a deposition what evidence would be necessary in the case. He responded, quote, "I guess an unimpeachable third-party witness." He said there would be no way of knowing who is telling the truth in a rape case. These quotes come from a piece in The Washington Post this weekend. Calls are mounting for the resignation of Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance as 40 more women accuse former Columbia University OBGYN Robert Haddon of sexual assault. The accusations follow recent revelations by Evelyn Yang, wife of former presidential candidate Andrew Yang, that Dr. Haddon assaulted her when she was pregnant. Cy Vance let Haddon off with a plea deal in 2016 that enabled him to avoid jail time. Evelyn Yang was attacked just 6 weeks after Haddon had been arrested in another case but was allowed to return to his practice. The total number of Haddon's accusers is now around 70. The allegations include vaginal exams without gloves, forceful touching, and forced oral sex. Joining the call for Cy Vance to resign are all 12 members of New York City Council's Women's Caucus. Co-chair Carlina Rivera said, quote, "There's a long history of District Attorney Vance's office failing to effectively prosecute other powerful white men," unquote. This as jury deliberations begin today in Harvey Weinstein's rape trial in New York. We'll have more on that story after headlines with New York Magazine's Irene Carmone. At least 150 million people in China, over 10% of the population, now face some level of restrictions on their movements because of the government-imposed lockdown as it attempts to slow down the spread of the coronavirus. Over 72,000 cases have been confirmed, with nearly 1,900 fatalities, most of these in China. Today, a noted neurologist and director of a hospital in Wuhan, the epicenter of the outbreak, died from coronavirus. Meanwhile, the quarantine aboard the Diamond Princess cruise ship that has been docked in Yokohama, Japan, for over 2 weeks is set to end tomorrow. More than 540 cases have been linked to the ship. Over 300 Americans were repatriated from Japan yesterday, with 14 testing positive for the disease. They'll now be quarantined on U.S. bases for 2 weeks. In business news, Apple says it will not meet its revenue goals because, in part, of the impact of coronavirus on their production in China. In Pakistan, a suicide bomb attack at a religious rally in the northern city of Quetta has killed at least 8 people and wounded at least 16 others. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the attack. In Mexico, the brutal killing of a 7-year-old girl has triggered more protests in Mexico City as anger mounts over the epidemic of murdered women and girls. The girl, Fatima, was kidnapped last week, her body found by authorities wrapped in a plastic bag. Her killing came just 2 days after a 25-year-old woman, Ingrid Escamilla, was murdered and mutilated by her boyfriend. This is one of the protesters Monday, a resident of the neighborhood where 7-year-old Fatima lived.
That's why we voted for this president who is going to end corruption. But what has the president done? Pure blah, blah, blah. And his airplane. Leave the airplane alone already. Start thinking about the poor people and leave the airplane alone.
The second strongest non-tropical storm ever recorded in the North Atlantic Ocean is wreaking havoc in towns across the United Kingdom. British authorities have issued over 300 warnings as bomb cyclone Dennis has produced 80-foot waves and winds reaching up to 90 miles per hour. The record rains and flooding disrupted air and train travel and killed at least 2 people. Amidst the catastrophic weather event, the British Environment Agency will reportedly announce homeowners should no longer longer expect to be protected from major floods because they'll be seen as inevitable due to the worsening climate crisis. Back in the United States, residents of Mississippi are bracing for more heavy rains as historic flooding from the swollen Pearl River has affected hundreds of homes. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves declared a state of emergency as the Pearl River crested Monday at its third highest recorded level. California is set to apologize this week for the internment of over 110,000 Japanese Americans during World War II. Lawmakers are expected to pass a resolution Thursday apologizing for supporting the, quote, unjust exclusion, removal, and incarceration of Japanese Americans and for its failure to support and defend the civil rights and civil liberties of Japanese Americans. In Virginia, state senators rejected a ban on assault weapons after four Democrats sided with Republicans to defeat the ban in committee. The measure would have prohibited the sale of magazines that hold over 12 rounds and some semi-automatic guns, including AR-15-style assault rifles, which have been used in the majority of mass shootings in the U.S. Democratic Governor Ralph Northam called for gun control reforms following last May's mass shooting in Virginia Beach that killed 13 people. Virginia Democrats, who took control of the legislature in November, have passed other gun control measures, including universal background checks, limits on handgun purchases to once a month, and a red flag bill allowing authorities to confiscate guns from individuals who may pose a danger to themselves or others. The Boy Scouts of America has filed for bankruptcy protection as it faces hundreds of lawsuits for sexual abuse. Several states have changed their laws to temporarily remove statutes of limitations on sex abuse, which previously protected groups like the Boy Scouts. At least 12,000 cases of abuse at the hands of Boy Scout masters and volunteers have been identified. And over 150 youth climate activists with the Sunrise Movement took over the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. Monday to hold a teach-in on the Green New Deal, calling on lawmakers to immediately adopt the measure. 20 teens, one as young as 13, were arrested during the demonstration. This is a student protester speaking at the action.
No matter who you are, you have a place at the table. That's why I ask my senators to co-sponsor this Green New Deal. I don't want any change in 5, 10, 20, 50 years. I want it f***ing now.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A jury of 7 men and 5 women meet today in New York Supreme Court to begin deliberations on whether to find disgrace movie mogul Harvey Weinstein guilty of rape and sexual assault. The case has drawn international attention amidst the Me Too movement. If the jurors find Weinstein guilty, he faces a maximum sentence of life in prison. Weinstein has been accused of sexual misconduct by more than 100 women. In this case, he faces 5 charges based on evidence relating to 2 main accusers. One woman, who wishes to remain anonymous, alleges she was raped by Weinstein in a New York hotel. He's been charged with rape in the first and third degrees in her case. The second main accuser is former Project Runway production assistant Miriam Haley, who alleges Weinstein forced oral sex on her in 2006. For this, Weinstein faces a count of criminal sex act. If the jury finds Weinstein guilty of charges relating to either or both of the main accusers, then it can consider 2 counts of predatory sexual assault. These charges would require the jurors to find Weinstein guilty of sexually assaulting more than one woman. Weinstein has pleaded not guilty. For more, we're joined in our New York studio by Irene Carmone, senior correspondent for New York Magazine, who's followed the allegations against Harvey Weinstein. She spoke more than a dozen of his accusers in her article 100 Women versus Harvey Weinstein, and wrote a 57-page PowerPoint Harvey Weinstein's team. She wrote about this this PowerPoint sent to reporters that smeared his alleged victims. Her new piece out today is headlined "The Woman Who Taped Harvey Weinstein." It features an interview with Amber Gutierrez, the Filipina-Italian model who reported Weinstein to the New York Police Department in 2015 for allegedly groping her during a meeting at his office. She then went back wearing a recording device for an arranged meetup at a hotel In the tape, Weinstein admits he groped her and tries to get her to come into his room. But the Manhattan District Attorney, Cyrus Vance, decided not to pursue the case and said, quote, a criminal charge is not supported. We're going to talk about all of these issues. Irene Carmon, it's great to have you back at Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me, Amy.
So let's start with the Weinstein case today. Mm-hmm. The closing arguments last week, and now this case goes to the jury. What should we understand about it?
More than almost any other case, this case has become synonymous with the Me Too movement. And that is not a coincidence. It was stories about Harvey Weinstein that were published in The New York Times and in The New Yorker that helped open up the floodgates from thousands, even millions of people telling stories of sexual assault. What changed from Ambra Gutierrez agreeing to wear a wire, 22 years old, taping Harvey Weinstein secretly, putting herself at risk, yet being hung out to dry by the New York DA? What changed between then and here we are, 5 years later, and the New York, the same Manhattan District Attorney's office, headed by Cy Vance, has brought these charges that are quite complex against Harvey Weinstein? What changed is that there was a flood of organizing. There were a flood of voices, not just about Harvey Weinstein, but, you know, the criminal law is a separate tool from public awareness, from journalism, as you well know. And so the question that is going to be at the heart of this case as we wait for the verdict and as the jury begins its deliberations is, have they proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt? And that is not going to be the same thing as, do you believe the 100-plus women who have come forward?
I want to go back to the story that you just dropped today for The Cut, for you're working for New York Magazine. Many people may remember, but explain to us what happened. Now, this is not what's at issue right now in this case. Mm-hmm. What happened with Ambra? Well, I mean, what's amazing about this, she didn't record herself. She worked with the police.
Yes.
She put herself in serious danger here.
Right.
Explain her bravery from the beginning.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because in 2017, when these stories were published, there was this great surprise. Wow, who knew? There were rumors, but people did not know the extent. But to my knowledge, she is the first person years before to have gone to the police with a report, to have done everything that the authorities asked her to do. She was 22 years old. She was in a country that she didn't grow up in. She's from the Philippines and from Italy. She says that Harvey Weinstein stuck his hand up her skirt and groped her breasts. He then called her while she was sitting at the Tribeca precinct, completely distraught. The Special Victims Unit sent her in with a wire. She was also secretly—
So he calls her. He, unbeknownst to him, she's sitting in the police precinct.
And she allows the cops to listen to the call. She then agrees the very next day, despite being deeply shaken by her experience, agrees to go back and meet with this man again, wearing a wire and recording on her phone a backup in case it failed, which it did fail. So just imagine what's going through her head as she's in this hotel lobby. Harvey Weinstein badgers her to go upstairs. Ronan Farrow later publishes this recording, a portion of which you hear Harvey Weinstein admitting that he groped her breasts, apologizing for it, saying he's used to it, she's upset, he's begging her to come into the room in the same kind of what Ashley Judd described as coercive bargaining that many of the women who have come forward about Weinstein have described, which is dangling job opportunities and then implying that in some way this means that women have to consent to sexual activity that many women have said they did not consent to.
And so then explain what happened to her doing the police's bidding, recording this.
Right.
She's got it in the bag or in the bug.
Yes.
She returns. And then what happens next?
So Amber believed she had done everything that they asked her to do. But then she was also, she describes it as, interrogated by Cy Vance's office, specifically by Martha Bashford. And at this point, she really feels like they put her on trial. Now, this is something that when folks report on sex crimes have heard a million times. Sometimes it is just that the DA really wants to make sure, is this somebody who's going to be comfortable being cross-examined on the stand? But nonetheless, she felt that she herself was being put on trial, despite the fact that she had recorded evidence of Harvey Weinstein admitting to groping her without her consent. And she left that meeting feeling uneasy. At the same time, Harvey Weinstein enlists powerful people. Ronan Farrow has reported Rudy Giuliani, Linda Fairstein, who was the former head of the sex crimes unit, are all putting pressure on the office not to bring charges against her. A public relations campaign is waged against her as well. She has worked as a model. Photographs of her in the most suggestive, out-of-context manner end up on the front page of the New York Post and the Daily News. She is accused of being a sex worker, which she says she was not. Things from her past are dragged out as if she herself is being put on trial in public opinion. And eventually, she learns from reading the newspaper, she says she didn't hear it from the DA's office, that they're not going to bring charges against Harvey Weinstein. And it will take 2.5 to 3 years for any charges to be brought in connection with more than 100 women who have accused Harvey Weinstein.
Martha Bashford is the chief prosecutor at the time, who is now, after 40 years—
in the sex crimes unit.
In the sex crimes unit, who has now said she is retiring. She just announced.
That's true.
And where did Linda Fairstein fit into this story?
Well, Linda Fairstein was part of Harvey Weinstein's team, and she is said to have had a close relationship with Martha Bashford and who have called her on Harvey Weinstein's behalf. And it's fascinating because you see how he also used the press as a tool. So you also suddenly have Harvey Weinstein being described as a married father of five and her being described as this sort of sex worker who is extorting poor Harvey Weinstein. Now that we have the recording, which took years to come out, despite the fact that Ambra did sign a non-disclosure agreement for $1 million, she said she feared for her family. She was supposed to hand over all evidence to Harvey Weinstein's attorneys, but she decided that she needed what she described to me as an escape plan. She held on to one of those recordings. They're kind of a spy games operation. Again, 22 years old, alone in this country, and she subsequently gave that recording to Ronan Farrow, and it helped buttress the reporting that was already being done in the New York Times and the New Yorker about the cascade of allegations against Harvey Weinstein.
And very interestingly, before we go on to this case, we had in headlines the story of Dr. Haddon, who's now, I think, 70 women have come forward saying he forcibly sexually assaulted them in his OBGYN office. He's Columbia University doctor. And the entire New York City Council Women's Caucus has called for Cy Vance's resignation. And one of the heads of the caucus said that they want to be sure that the district attorney is going to be involved in aggressively dealing with sexual assault and not privileging white men.
You know, Amy, does anybody believe that if Robert Haddon or Harvey Weinstein were low-wage workers, men of color who were lower on the social totem pole, that they wouldn't be sitting in jail right now based on the evidence against them? I think it is quite clear in sex crimes and in other crimes that we have an unequal system of justice. And now there are some efforts to even the scales. But it's challenging because the job of a powerful person who wants to get out of a possible charge against them is to make the price so high. Prosecutors are not known for wanting to bring cases that they're going to lose, right? They brag about their conviction rate. They don't take risks if they don't have to. And powerful people understand how to make the price so high that they may well lose the case. The prosecutors may well lose the case. And when they make that cost-benefit analysis and powerful people are in their ear and he's a wonderful pillar of the community or he's given so much money to these causes, that becomes a consideration. And it's only in the last couple of years that the voices of other people saying, this happened to me, this is my evidence, I agree to testify, is even making a dent in that.
So you had this remarkable cover story in New York Magazine with women one after another. You've interviewed about 12 of the nearly 100 who have accused Harvey Weinstein, though, to be clear, in this case, he's being charged in the case of two different women. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. We're talking with New York Magazine's Irene Carmone. Stay with us.
I'm not scared of you this time. And when you pick up the phone, I'll stay. And I'll do more than breathe this time. And I'll let
Not Scared by Tamberlin. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn right now back to the case of Harvey Weinstein in a New York courtroom today with jury deliberations, the disgraced movie mogul Harvey Weinstein has pleaded not guilty to sexually assaulting former production assistant Mimi Haley in 2006 and raping Jessica Mann, one-time aspiring actress, in 2013. This is one of Weinstein's lawyers, Donna Rotunno.
Well, I think the issue is, if you look at all the evidence shows consensual relationships. So if you claim that what you say happened, it belies common sense that you would then go out and send the emails, have the contact, continue relationships, send your phone numbers. So that's the reason. That is consent. The evidence shows consent.
For more, we are continuing with Irene Carmone, senior correspondent for New York Magazine, who has been writing about the Harvey Weinstein case for some time. I had an amazing cover story where women dressed in black linked arms, the article called 100 Women versus Harvey Weinstein. She also wrote about the 57-page PowerPoint Harvey Weinstein's team sent to reporters that smeared his alleged victims. She's the author of the New York Times bestseller, Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So let's talk about this case and how you think it's gone as the jury begins to deliberate today.
It's so interesting because we, from the beginning of Me Too going viral, have considered Harvey Weinstein to be this kind of untouchable monster by which all other accusations are measured. But the truth is, it's really complicated to bring a criminal case, especially years after many of these allegations were said to take place. So if you could imagine a big funnel where there are 100 and possibly more women out there, but then how many of them have chargeable cases just from the point of view of statutes of limitations? How many of them have evidence? How many of them are willing to talk to prosecutors? Because participating in a criminal case like this is wrenching. And in fact, they brought a case on behalf of, in New York, Lucia Evans, that was later dropped, even though she also cooperated with Cy Vance's office. So you don't even know if your case will see the light of day. From that, we have two women, Jessica Mann and Mimi Haley, whose charges form the basis of the New York case, and there's also going to be a Los Angeles case. And one of the reasons that there is a lot of complexity is because the jury is being asked to understand something that experts will tell you is typical, but that society doesn't generally understand, which is, how can it be that on one day, somebody, you say, sexually assaults you, but then further down the line, you continue to have consensual contact with them, whether it's friendly conversation in the form of an email or asking them for a professional opportunity. Now, the prosecutors have tried to square this circle, which, again, experts say is incredibly typical. You could think about it as being kind of akin to a domestic violence situation. But will the jury understand it? This is how the prosecutors have tried to explain it, that this is a man who held so much economic power in the industry, a man who they saw as holding the keys to their future, and also that they were terrified of him. They were terrified of his rage and the violence, and they wanted to tell a story of themselves that this was consensual. The defense has actually seen this case as not just a war about the facts, not just does Harvey Weinstein deserve due process. They are waging a war against the entire Me Too movement. Donna Rotunno and the rest of the team are coming out and saying, actually, it's not. Harvey Weinstein is a victim of these women and a target of a cause and a movement. So they have tried to make this as much about the backlash to that movement as possible.
And how do you think the prosecutors have done in this case?
You know, it's a tough case because it would not have been brought had there not been such raised awareness about the complex dynamics around sexual assault. I do not know whether there are members of a jury willing to unanimously convict based on facts that, again, experts will tell you are completely typical of people who experience trauma, but are relatively new ideas for society at large to accept. They've also pursued a strategy that I think is risky, which is that they have focused on Harvey Weinstein's body. They distributed photos of him to the jury naked, which were then drawn by court artists. And they have asked several of the women who testified, because in addition to the two women who testified, whose case formed the basis of the charges, there have also been other women like Annabella Sciorra and other individuals who say they were assaulted by Harvey, but whose cases can't be criminally charged in this context. And a couple of them have spoken about how disgusting they found Harvey Weinstein's body, specific details about his genitalia. And at listening to this, you do wonder whether this focus, because nobody denies that sexual contact took place, might risk playing into the defense's argument that he's a victim, or might look like the prosecutors are trying to humiliate him. And I do wonder whether the jury will listen to that and actually kind of feel bad for Harvey, who has been coming into the courtroom every day with a walker. Right? Who has, they've been spinning the story that he's just a loser who beautiful women exploited. So will that work for the prosecutors? I think we're about to find out. Mm.
And very quickly, with the presidential race, Michael Bloomberg coming under major scrutiny around his comments about women and scores of lawsuits against him and his company related to women and sexual harassment. Let me ask you about specifically a case that you have looked particularly at, and that's the story of Charlie Rose, who mm-hmm. worked out of Bloomberg's big building in New York City. That's mm-hmm. where his studios were, was a very close friend of Bloomberg, and what Bloomberg's comments have been about him.
So Bloomberg has said that they had no idea about any allegations. There's no records. We investigated as well. They were told us there were no records. But he has also repeatedly said that there are two sides to every story, and he's not sure if he believes it. Over the years, they've been reported to be very close friends. There was a piece in the Washington Post in the 90s where they talked about how, I think Charlie said, you know, there's a lot of locker room talk. We're both bachelors together. Definitely a warm relationship that he then came out and defended Charlie Rose. There is litigation ongoing in the Charlie Rose case. Both his former makeup artists and three of his former assistants are continuing to sue him, and he's been deposed in that case. Michael Bloomberg said at the time that nothing had been proven in a court of law. But as we saw from our Weinstein conversation, you know, the role of journalism and the role of the criminal system are slightly different, and not everything fits into a criminal case.
Hmm. Well, Irene Camone, thank you so much for your excellent reporting. Senior correspondent for New York Magazine, who's followed the allegations against Harvey Weinstein. We will link to her piece today that has just come out, and the previous piece where she looked at a number of the 100 women who have accusations against Harvey Weinstein. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Democratic presidential candidates will face off in Las Vegas Wednesday night ahead of the Nevada caucuses. It's the first debate with billionaire Michael Bloomberg on the stage, and Nevada could be a decisive state for candidates who perform poorly in Iowa and New Hampshire, including former Vice President Joe Biden. As Biden hopes for a comeback, a new short documentary sheds light on his extensive role advocating for the Iraq War, an issue that's been raised repeatedly on the campaign trail. Biden has apologized for supporting the war, but today in a broadcast exclusive, we're going to bring you a new film directed by the Center for Economic and Policy Research's Mike Weisbrot that exposes Biden's central role in pushing for an Iraq invasion. It's called Worth the Price, Joe Biden and the Launch of the Iraq War. The documentary is narrated by Danny Glover. But before we go to it, we're going to the director himself, Mark Weisbrot, to talk as we go back in time some 16, 17 years, Mark. Just give us a little introduction to why you decided to make this film now about the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Mark?
Yes, I couldn't hear you.
Oh, Mark, I'm just asking if you can just do a little introduction to this film, why you've decided to go back 16, 17 years to bring us a film about a current presidential candidate, Joe Biden, why you think it's so significant, his stance on the Iraq War in 2002.
Yes, well, first, you know, a lot of people think he's going to lose and maybe it doesn't matter, but he is still in the race. And even if he loses, and I think he probably will, he still could very easily play a role if there's a brokered convention, which you talked about on this show. He could play a role in the decision of who the candidate is. And I think that's one of the reasons he's staying in the race, trying to get through Super Tuesday and so on. But the second thing is, this is vitally important, and it really hasn't been discussed on television. I want to thank you for having this show. You've had his vote for the Iraq War has been brought up, but there's never been a presentation of what he actually did, which was he was the most important elected official in this country after George W. Bush and Dick Cheney in enabling and allowing and getting the authorization for the war through Congress. That was a huge role in bringing us this war. It wasn't just a vote for the war. He was the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And, you know, when I was going through this footage, it was amazing all the things that he did. He argued very strongly for the war.
And we're going to hear that in just 1 minute and then talk to you on the other side. Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy Research's documentary, Worth the Price, Joe Biden and the Launch of the Iraq War. We'll bring it to you in 30 seconds. Staring at the Sun by TV on the radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to the new documentary short, Worth the Price, Joe Biden and the Launch of the Iraq War. It's narrated by Danny Glover.
Our American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world.
The costs of the Iraq War were enormous. More than 4,500 American soldiers, as well as thousands of military contractors, were killed. Tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers were wounded. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, and by some estimates, more than 1 million were killed. And the war created massive instability, including more wars and terrorism throughout the Middle East and North Africa. Fast forward to the 2020 presidential race. There's only one candidate for the nomination of the Democratic Party who played a leading role in actually making the Iraq War happen.
In my judgment, President Bush is right to be concerned about Saddam Hussein's relentless pursuit of weapons of mass destruction and the possibility that he may use them or share them with terrorists. Other regimes hostile to the United States and our allies already have or seek to acquire weapons of mass destruction.
This was Joe Biden in 2002 speaking as chair of the United States Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. A few months later, when the Senate was debating whether to give President George W. Bush the authority to start a war with Iraq, Biden argued strongly in favor of granting this authority.
The objective is to compel Iraq to destroy its illegal weapons of mass destruction and its program to develop and produce missiles and more of those weapons. Saddam is dangerous. The world would be a better place without him. But the reason he poses a growing danger to the United States and its allies is that he possesses chemical and biological weapons and is seeking nuclear weapons. And unlike my colleague from West Virginia and Maryland, I do not believe this is a rush to war. I believe it's a march to peace and security. I believe that failure to overwhelmingly support this resolution is likely to enhance the prospects that war will occur.
Joe Biden did so much more than vote for the war. He was the chair of the powerful Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, and he really used his control over that committee to make sure that a majority of the U.S. Senate voted to authorize the war. And that's a very serious thing.
Historian Barbara Ransby.
It's questionable whether the authorization to start the war could have even passed Congress without all that Biden did to get it approved. improve. So he really did play a major role in bringing us into the Iraq War, a terrible, terrible war. And this was much more responsibility. He bears much more responsibility than many other senators who simply voted for it. Of course, the statement about chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons were false. And many experts already concluded this at the time of the Senate hearings, but Biden didn't allow these experts to testify. That's really significant. As chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, Biden was able to control the Senate debate on the war, and therefore much of the information that most senators received and that major media outlets reported was really distorted.
There were other Democrats in the Senate who wanted to put limits on Bush's ability to start a war in Iraq. For example, if there was no imminent threat to the United States and the United Nations did not authorize a war, then President Bush would have to come back to Congress for another resolution. But Biden shot this down.
So the reason why I oppose the amendment of my friend from Michigan is because the basic premise upon which I began is consistent with where my friend from Connecticut begins, and that is that the threat need not be imminent for us to take action. That's authority we're about to delegate to the president.
So the fact that he would take such a stridently pro-war position, that he would use that role to limit the debate the way he did, played a major factor in getting the enough defections from the Democratic majority to join with almost unanimous Republican support to make the war resolution pass.
Professor Stephen Zunes.
As a result, I don't think it would be unfair to say that Biden played a more important role than probably anybody in Congress in making the Iraq War possible. The idea that Iraq, which had been rid of its non-conventional weapons and weapons programs and weapon systems, that was under the strictest sanctions of any nation has ever experienced, was somehow a threat to the United States and the far side of the world is totally absurd. I mean, totally ridiculous. I mean, the fact that an educated person like Joe Biden with foreign policy experience would believe that, it really defies the imagination.
But the witnesses mostly reinforced the pro-war arguments.
The question before us really is, should the United States depose Saddam Hussein? And my answer is clearly yes.
My suggestion, as I stated earlier, is that regime change, as the stated U.S. policy, would be the correct way to deal with this problem.
In my opinion, weapons inspections are not the answer to the real problem, which is the regime.
And the people want a regime change. Let's help them to make this change and liberate Iraq from this oppressor.
Iraq has enough to generate the needed bomb-grade uranium for 3 nuclear weapons by 2005. It is too difficult to see how any measure short of a regime change will be effective.
A nuclear-armed Saddam sometime in this decade is a risk we cannot choose to ignore.
It is essential to recognize that the claim made by Saddam's representatives that Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction is false.
We know that Iraq permits known al-Qaeda members to live and move freely about in Iraq. I am told that that is the case, that the al-Qaeda groups are welcome and that they're being supported, their families are being supported.
I have to tell you, Iraqis desperately want to be freed of Saddam Hussein, and they also know that the only country that can help them with this is the United States. And they are ready to welcome the U.S. as liberators.
Senator Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island pushed back against the witnesses being stacked, but Biden cut him off.
And I do think that it would have been good to have that perspective on this panel for a better balance. I think we've got from this panel a perspective that the threat is very real, very immediate. And I maybe would ask you to comment on some of these senior military officials, including, according to the article, members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and their
General Yield, just for a moment, I apologize, but...
Excuse me.
The senator from Florida is going to chair the hearing. I have to leave for a few minutes. And after this panel is over, we'll recess for... how much time for lunch? 45 minutes for lunch when this panel, I'm not suggesting we finish now, but when the panel is finished, we're recessed for 45 minutes. And I assure you, Senator, there are other witnesses coming along who think the policy of containment is just fine. So I hope you'll find this is extremely balanced when when we finish the whole 2 days of hearings. But I thank you for your letting me interrupt and I turning the gavel over.
Biden never returned to the problem that Senator Chafee raised about the bias of the witnesses that were allowed to testify.
Matthew Ho.
I was in the Iraq War twice and in the Afghan War once. You know, for veterans, these wars have had an impact that lasts for our whole lives. The Iraq War, almost 4,600 American soldiers were killed there. I think as of the first month of 2020, I think that the total number is 4,575. And that's just the direct number killed because war has been privatized and contracted out, and companies are making money off of it. The estimates are that a similar number, about 4,500 contractors, men and women who were doing jobs in the military that in past wars soldiers would have been doing, were also killed in Iraq. So when you look at the number killed, you have to look at, say, 9,000 rather than almost than 4,500. That does not take into account the suicides. The suicides from these wars, based upon Veterans Administration data, runs between 9,000 and 10,000 killed by suicide. We've also had, tens of thousands of men and women wounded in action. I have Marines in my command who were hit by roadside bombs 9-10 times during a deployment. This is why I think so many of us who were in these wars are so disgusted by the political system, so upset and furious that people who were responsible for these wars, who had a constitutional responsibility for oversight, just went along with the groupthink, just got rid of any intellectual honesty or moral honesty.
President Barack Obama.
ISIL is a direct outgrowth of al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
That grew out of our invasion, which is an example of unintended consequences, which is why we should generally aim before we shoot.
Stephen Kinzer.
Decapitated the government there, left no indigenous leadership, and that not only allowed all sorts of groups within Iraq to revolt against what they saw as an illegitimate occupier, but it attracted jihadist fanatics from around the world. They looked at Iraq and saw, here's the place where we can go kill American soldiers. And they poured in. They're gaining experience for future wars. So without the sin of the Iraq invasion, we wouldn't be dealing with ISIS today.
Vincent Canestraro.
First time in my 27 years in intelligence, the first time I have ever heard of a vice president of the United States going out to CIA and sitting down with desk-level analysts, sitting down and debating with junior-level analysts and pushing them to find support for something he personally believes, that Saddam was trying to acquire uranium. That, to me, is pressure, and that's intimidation. And they're not going to say, well, Mr. Vice President, you're full of it.
Lawrence Wilkerson.
They were manufacturing the case in the bowels of the CIA for Saddam Hussein's possession of weapons of mass destruction.
And in the United States Congress. One of the false stories that the Bush administration used to promote the war with Iraq was that Saddam Hussein was actually connected with al-Qaeda, the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks.
President George W. Bush.
Oh, the reason I keep insisting that there was a relationship between Iraq and Saddam and al-Qaeda, because there was a relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda was included in the resolution that Biden pushed through the Senate, which gave Bush the authority to go to war.
Stephen Kinzer.
Anybody who had the slightest knowledge about that region would realize the absurdity of the connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, who actually were bitter enemies. I was in Iraq when Saddam Hussein was in power. Saddam did not tolerate any form of religious extremism. If you were sitting in a cafe and you said to the person next to you, our government really isn't religious enough, we should have more piety, anxiety from our leaders and in our policies, you'd probably be arrested within an hour. There was no chance of al-Qaeda or any kind of religious extremist group from getting a foothold in Iraq while Saddam Hussein was in power.
After Bush invaded, Biden continued to support the war for years.
Some of my own party have said that it was a mistake to go to Iraq in the first place and believe that it's not worth the cost, whatever benefit may flow from our engagement in Iraq. But the cost of not acting against Saddam, I think, would have been much greater. And so is the cost, and so will be the cost, of not finishing this job. The President of the United States is a bold leader, and he is popular. The stakes are high, and the need for leadership is great. I wish he'd use some of his stored-up popularity to make what I admit is not a very popular case. But I and many others will support him. 9 months ago, I voted with my colleagues to give the President of the United States of America the authority to use force. And I would vote that way again today. It was a right vote then, and it'd be a correct vote today.
Lawrence Wilkerson.
And President Obama in the Roosevelt Room essentially told me this. September the 10th, 2015, he started off the conversation with these words: there's a bias in this town toward war. I almost fell off my seat. And then he told us for the next 20, 25 minutes that he didn't know what to do about it. There's a bias in this town toward war, said the President of the United States. We have a machine in Washington. It consists of predatory capitalists like Lockheed Martin and ExxonMobil and all they represent. ExxonMobil sells more fossil fuel to DOD than any other entity in the world. Lockheed Martin, the biggest weapons merchant in the world, makes a fortune off war. So does Raytheon, Grumman, and Boeing. As long as you have these dollars rolling in, you're going to have constant, endless war.
Professor Adam Getachew.
In the United States, Biden represents a kind of a longstanding bipartisan commitment to U.S. preeminence on the global stage, in which the U.S. acts as the policeman of the world. I think a lot of Americans are frustrated by this position. They want to have a different kind of relationship to the world, and they want a leader, a president, and a Congress that can present a vision of prosperity for all Americans. I think that only happens when we break with this cycle of endless wars. It is going to be very difficult, I think, for a Democratic Party candidate who basically reiterates the status quo of endless military interventions, endless wars in the Middle East, to win against Donald Trump.
Dick Durbin.
At the time of this debate, I was a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And I would read the headlines in the paper in the morning, and I'd watch the television newscast, and I'd shake my head. Because you see, just a few hundred feet away from here, in a closed room, carefully guarded, the Intelligence Committee was meeting on a daily basis for top secret briefings about the information we were receiving, and the information we had in the Intelligence Committee was not the same information being given to the American people. I couldn't believe it.
President George W. Bush.
Facing clear evidence of peril. We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Senator Dick Durbin.
So what happened? We invaded, turned loose hundreds, if not thousands, of people scouring Iraq for these weapons of mass destruction. Never found one of them. Looked for nuclear weapons. No evidence whatsoever. Went into our intelligence files and said, okay, Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, let's get this linkage put together once and for all. No evidence at all of a linkage. The American people were deceived into this war.
Matthew Ho.
I tell you what, I don't understand how any of these politicians who claim to support the troops and support their families, I don't understand how anyone could hold a mother at the funeral of her son, who just turned 20, who was killed either in the wars or because of suicide, and I've done both, and there's no difference for the mother, and act as if somehow there's some benefit to these wars, when it's demonstrably not. You know, and then you're over there, and you're fighting in it, and you're taking part in it. And, you know, as an officer, I was responsible for my Marines and for my sailors and for, I had their lives and I was responsible to their families for that. And you do, you think, can I go home and say to the families that it was worth it, that their son was killed, their husband was killed, their brother was killed for something that was good or something that was beneficial.
Senator Joe Biden.
At the outset, if we can make the case, which I think, well, I won't say what I think yet, the hearings aren't finished, but if we can make the case that the threat is real and dire, that a free and democratic Iraq, if it could be accomplished, could have a cleansing impact on that part of the world and make our life easier significantly down the road, which I think could be made in an ideal circumstance. Not even an ideal, in a, if we do things right, that it is worth the price.
That's the broadcast exclusive of Worth the Price, Joe Biden and the launch of the Iraq War. It's narrated by Danny Glover, directed by Mark Weisbrot with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who is joining us from Washington, D.C. So in these last 2 minutes, we have Mark. Now, again, on the campaign trail, presidential candidate Biden has said in one form or another he made a mistake on Iraq. Your response?
Well, I think that's just too little and too late. It's not enough. You know, this really has to be an issue. This can't be swept under the rug. And we're entering a different period right now, I think, is very crucial. We could have another war even before the election. You had President Trump come very close to a war with Iran when he ordered the assassination of General Soleimani and just a month ago. And this is something that also, the other part of it on the positive side, there's enormous resistance to this in Congress. You have Bernie Sanders, for instance, introduced the No War with Iran Act, and he also led the fight, which was successful, to get both houses of Congress, and this was using the War Powers Resolution for the first time in 45 years, both houses of Congress voted to order the U.S. military to get out of this war in Yemen, which has killed hundreds of thousands of people. So there's a real strong movement now to put an end to these endless wars. And these wars will go on forever if we don't allow this to even be discussed. We have to have this discussion. This is somebody who's running for president of the United States, and he played a major role in bringing about this war that killed, by the best estimates, 1 million people and thousands of U.S., over 4,500 U.S. soldiers. And here it is. His role hasn't even been discussed. At the very least, people voting in the Democratic primary should know what he did.
Interestingly, Mark Weisbrot, the Los Angeles Times recently had a piece. Here you have Joe Biden apologizing for what he did, and you really lay out clearly how he was not only supporting the war, but leading the support. Mayor Bloomberg, when interviewed by the Los Angeles Times, said he didn't regret backing the Iraq War back then.
Yes, that's another reason. I mean, because it's Bloomberg, too. So this is an issue in the race. And, you know, this is even bigger than that, because for, you know, the last 50 years, the peace movement has always pointed out that when you build a fighter plane, you're giving up on health care for thousands of people. But it's even worse than that now, because now the intellectuals of the so-called national security state are, well, they're talking about an arms race with China. You could forget about the Green New Deal, Medicare for all, and everything else, because that their economy is already 30% bigger than ours and is going to be twice as big within 10 years. So this affects everything that anybody who cares about this presidential election wants.
Mark Weisbrot, I want to thank you for being with us, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana, Wednesday night at 6, moderating a panel with Mahatma Gandhi's grandson, Arun Gandhi, Archbishop Desmond Tutu's daughter, Reverend Naomi Tutu, President Reagan's son, Ronald Reagan Jr., Reza Aslan, and more. Check out democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!